This is Karen Brewster, and today is November 4th, 2021, and I'm here with Sharon Long in Anchorage, Alaska, for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox Project. So Sharon, thank you.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Great. So before we get started on the trail, you can tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, how I came to be part of this project.
Well, and how you came to be in Alaska, or how you came to be.
How I came to be in Alaska. Well, I was a difficult child, and I was sent here to live with some aunties, but that was a long time ago. No, I had been working at the Joint Federal State Land Use Planning Commission back in the early 70s, and So we were in the midst of state land selections under the Statehood Act, and then here came the Native Claims Settlement Act and Section 17D2 for, you know, federal withdrawals for lands, and so that's how I became familiar with sort of this sector. And so having worked with the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission, the Department of DNR, I ended up actually leaving after my work there, put a pack on my back, and went around the world with a girlfriend for a year, and ended up back in Washington, D.C., without enough money to get back to Alaska. So I went into my senator's office and applied for a job. I had worked on his original campaign. I was the student statewide campaign manager for Gravel's campaign, and so he knew me from that. And then we talked about my background with the resource planning team and the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission, and I ended up working for him as one of the legislative assistants on natural resources, forestry, land claims, you know, natural resources issues.
Okay, and what is your educational background that you ended up doing lands issues?
I just sort of grew through my experience with working in the legislature, working in it was Department of Education, and then Department of Natural Resources. I was a graphic artist, and ended up being out on the ground with the resource planning team members during the Wild and Scenic River studies, and had lots of exposure to the legislation and political issues of the time. Worked on campaigns, was in the mix of all of that. Had gone to University of Alaska and Alaska Methodist University as a political science and an English major, and you know, just experience in a state that was becoming itself, and got to grow up with some of those early issues. We're a huge resource state, so land and resources was an appealing path to follow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what year did you start working for Gravel in Washington?
That would have been 1976. Came off the world tour in the fall of 1976. Went in there. Spent 2 years there.
Okay. And remind me when Gravel was elected senator.
Oh,
do you remember? How long had he been in office?
This was his second. He was elected in 68, so they're six-year terms, right? And 14, so he must have just been reelected.
Okay, so yeah, so he wasn't a new senator.
He wasn't brand new, but right. I mean, okay. By the terms of the Senate, he wasn't an oldie either.
Right, okay. So what kinds of natural resources issues were you working on for him?
We did an amendment. The National Forest Management Practices Act hadn't been amended since the 1890s, and we were trying to bring it up to the current century with forestry practices because of you know, our huge forests here. And we amended mining laws, we amended forest management practices to advocate for Western states. Gravel routinely aligned himself with Western states because we had the same, you know, issues with federal overreach. So, yeah, forestry, land claims. I spent a lot of time on Section 17 D2 mm-hmm. of the Claims Act and the D2 withdrawals, and then eventually came back to be director of the D2 Council on Alaska Lands here. They created that after I left Gravel's office. I came back here to do that under... I think it was a legislative committee to start, and then Governor Hammond, it moved to the governor's office, and so I was working for Governor Hammond on the D2 land stuff. But what other things did I work on for Gravel? Forestry, land claims, didn't do any of the oil and, or not much of the oil and gas stuff.
The pipeline would have been somebody else.
Yes. And of course, the Iditarod, the National Historic Trails Act came under that.
Okay, so that's a good lead in to the National Historic Trails Act.
Yes, which had been passed previously, I believe, and only had two designations in it. They had historic trails and recreation trails. And I haven't been able to scratch this memory enough to come up with the genesis of the idea for historic trails. I don't know if it was Gravel, if it was Stevens, if it was, I don't know whose idea that was. It may have been in Department of Interior, I don't know. But anyway, it was decided. Joe Reddington was spearheading a campaign to get the trail recognized for its historic values. And so we wanted to amend the Trails Act to create a subsection for historic trails in addition to scenic and recreation and include the Iditarod. The first two to be included, the ones that were going to be sort of the premier or inaugural trails, were going to be the Oregon Trail and the Iditarod. Now, there was another trail that came in the same time, and I think it's the Mormon
Trail.
The Mormon Trails. Yeah. And I can't remember what the power structure was with Utah at the time. Let's see, it would have been Orrin Hatch. You know, I can't remember the senators there. So that was the start. We needed to amend the Trails Act to create this new subsection of historic, and the premier trails to go in were going to be the Oregon Trail and the Iditarod.
Okay. And so how did you go about doing that?
First I remember, I talked to Joe Reddington, of course, and he had the history that he knew. But then we did a Congressional Research Service piece on it, too. They did, I think, quite a comprehensive search. We found as much background as we could. And you have the amendment drafted, and you shop the amendment around. You look at the political landscape and see who is in the leadership. You know, Jimmy Carter had been elected, and the control in the House and the Senate were Democrats. And so we had a good chance of moving it fairly quickly. It was the 95th Congress. And so we drafted the amendment, and people with a higher pay grade than I knew the political landscape amongst the Western senators and did whatever magic they had to do to know that we'd have good sponsorship once it was introduced. And we had, you know, Scoop Jackson sponsored it, and Frank Church sponsored it. and both senators from the state of Alaska sponsored it. And some people might think, well, that's a no-brainer, of course. But there was such vitriol between our two senators that this was a good thing for Alaska. Everyone could see that. So the staffs were a little bit cagey in presenting the strategy to the senators about getting this thing passed in one Congress. And so both senators had committed themselves so far in, yes, this is a great idea. We didn't want them to get into a fight over who was going to be the prime sponsor. And so it's obvious that people with more seniority and more power should be the prime sponsors. And then, of course, both senators would, senators from Alaska would co-sponsor it. So I guess the senators were groomed a little bit by their staffs in the end to make them both look good. How would it have looked if there had been some kind of brouhaha amongst our senators over something as obviously good for the state as this? So we worked it. They introduced it. Both of them were sponsors. And I wasn't there. I left to come back to Alaska to do the D2 council before it was passed. Pat Porchot was there and saw it through. Don Young, when it went over to the House, I don't think we had companion legislation over there. I think it was the Senate bill that carried it. Do you know that?
No, I don't.
No, okay. I'm assuming, and stand to be corrected, but I assume, and Pat will know this better than I assume it went through, and Don Young was on Interior. I think he's been on Interior his whole life over there. And so I don't think it was a problem in the House. Tip O'Neill was the Speaker. The House was controlled by the Dems, and
it obviously passed.
Yeah. And Jimmy Carter was the president. There's no reason not to sign it.
And Senator Church was from what state?
Senator Church was from Idaho. And I don't know if the Oregon Trail skirts the lower boundary of his state. You know, there are maps all in the interior, which people can refer to that were drawn.
Right, because I'm wondering why... Well, Jackson was Washington.
I mean, he's a Western senator.
Okay.
And was chair of now Interior and Insular Affairs. And you know who I think, someone else you might talk to, who I think was a staffer for Scoop Jackson, was Greg Erickson, who's another Alaskan. I mean, he did energy issues, but he might remember some of this.
Yeah, because I was thinking why Jackson and Church sponsored... That's because they were the more powerful senators.
They had chairs of significant... I mean, Scoop was chair of the overall committee.
Right.
And I'm assuming that Church must have been chair of a subcommittee that would have, to which this would have been referred.
Okay. Well, Pat mentioned something about it being a standalone bill initially for the historic trail before it became...
Part of the Trails Act?
The Iditarod Trail part, before it became part of Church's legislation. Does that ring a bell to you?
That does not ring a bell to me.
Okay.
My recollection is that in order to get it to go, we needed to amend the Trails Act, create the historic designation, and put in the Oregon Trail in the Iditarod.
Okay. And did you work with other people, or did the senator's office hear from other people besides Joe Reddington? Do you remember other people who were working?
You know, I don't remember the other folks. I spoke mostly with Joe. I didn't meet Leo until after we got on the council together. You know, I was just had my nose down doing my little legislative work, doing the research, you know, speaking to drafting about how the amendment would read, dealing with Interior about what the requirements might be, knowing maps had to be drawn. And, you know, drawing the maps was an interesting exercise because, you know, you're in the midst of all this land selection going on, native claims selection, federal withdrawals, state selections, and here comes this trail, which wasn't on, at the time, wasn't on any of the state selection maps, you know, duh. So there were a lot of people protecting their territory, terra firma territory, right, as well as political territory. So it was another interesting resource adventure with the feds and the state and our indigenous people. And
so how did you get the trail marked on the map? How did you know where to put it?
Well, you talk to people. We talked to users. People had to. Joe Reddington was instrumental in that. They had to determine historic uses, and that's when all the attendant gold rush trails sort of became apparent. It wasn't just the Serum Race Trail, that this had history beyond the race. So I assume it was Interior that was out there on the ground trying to figure out historic uses. Certainly a Senate committee's not gonna go do that.
Well, so there was this Bureau of Recreation study done.
What year was that? Recreation is different than the uses.
No, but it was done under that. It was in 70. Yeah, here. The Iditarod Trail, Seward to Nome Route, and other Alaskan Gold Rush Trails, April 1977. A cooperative study prepared by the Northwest Regional Office, Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, under the authority of the National Trails System Act. And that's what Pat worked on, and that was to look at all the gold rush trails in Alaska to determine, mm-hmm, which I think in the original act it was just put in gold rush trails,
mm-hmm,
and then this report and this group looked at which gold rush trails and then recommended the Iditarod made the most sense, you know, rather,
yeah,
than the Chilkoot or.
So Pat was working on that then?
And then he came to Gravel
after
that.
Yeah. So he came with some ground knowledge that,
right,
I didn't have. I was the legislative assistant for Gravel on these natural resources issues.
Right.
And then.
But sort of simultaneously, 76.
So he had been working on those,
right,
things. And then he came, when I left, he took my job,
right,
at Gravel's office.
So, yeah, so you were doing the legislative,
DC political
end,
stuff,
and
yeah,
while he was doing
on the ground
research, and
yeah,
yeah, okay, so that's why there might be,
yeah,
some, but that's where,
yeah,
the recommendation for the Iditarod to be the historic trail for Alaska came from.
So maybe the idea came from that study that,
mm-hmm,
we need another designation being historic,
yeah, well,
because
I,
it didn't fit under recreational,
right,
or scenic.
Well, I know there was a national thing that originally the Trails Act was scenic trails, and then they added historic on a national,
well,
level.
Scenic and recreation, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I know that historic got added later nationally.
Yes.
And I think, if I understand it right, that in that when historic trails were getting put in, it was put as a generic gold rush trails in Alaska, but it didn't specify the Iditarod. And then that study is where they came up with the Iditarod specifically.
Now that's interesting, because my recollection is that we had to have the historic designation, that had to come into play for us to put that in, because the Iditarod didn't qualify under the other designations.
Right.
So.
Well,
So we'd have to go back to early hearings on the creation of the act, go back and get transcripts from that and see what happened.
That's why oral history is very interesting, and it always, you know, the documents and the oral history work together, because, you know, talking to people like you who are in the back room doing that negotiating, like, okay, what were the issues you were talking about? Who were you talking to? Mm-hmm. What was the push and pull?
Oh, yeah.
Especially on the staff side, I think a lot of people don't realize how much work legislative staff does in crafting all this.
Well, and it was fun to work with, you know, Stephen's staff and Gravel's staff were very collegial. We worked a lot together. We're Alaskans. We're working for Alaska. We know our bosses had different styles. They may have had different aspirations, but the collegiality amongst the staffs I found to be very, very helpful and to the benefit of the state.
I was just going to ask something about that. You know, as you say, the Iditarod Trail seems like such a small little issue, mm-hmm. but you were starting to work on it in 76, you said.
I got there in 76. I don't know when exactly Joe Reddington, when the legislative director assigned this. The idea came to the office somehow, and, you know, I'm just the staff person that, okay, this is your issue, we're going to get this designation, got to get the legislation drafted, work it.
Right, and that it took a couple years.
It took a couple years, but I think it all happened within the 95th Congress.
Okay, which is a couple year Congress.
It'd be public law. So when
it's public law 95 something.
Okay, so yeah, it all happened.
I think
six something.
Public law 95-625, 95th Congress.
Yeah,
November 10th, 1978. Oh, we're coming up on the anniversary.
Yes. So that was...
Yeah, it included the Iditarod National Historic Trail. So that's the national act. And then it included the Iditarod in there, establishment of advisory councils, and the requirement mm-hmm. that they do a trail management plan. Oh, here.
It says public law what?
95-625. Mm-hmm. But here, okay. Wait. I have some other... Public Law 90-543, October 2nd, 1968.
Mm-hmm.
The National Trail System recommended to Congress that suitable for national. I think
Public
that
Law 90 what?
90-543.
Yeah, that's a long time before.
That was 1968.
And so was that the creation of the Trails Act? The original Trails Act?
Maybe.
I think so.
Yes. Recommend to Congress that it was suitable for national trail designation. Anyway, yeah, it is a bit of a convoluted history.
We should find that CRS report. Or people listening to this that are interested. There's a Congressional Research Service report.
I can see if I can find that. Because I don't know that I've heard that before. So I know the one that the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation did, but that was different than...
Mm-hmm. What would have been done for Congress.
Yeah. Who was the legislative director for Gravel when you were hired, who assigned you?
Don Argetsinger.
How do you spell that?
Argetsinger.
Okay.
So the legislative director at the time was Don Argetsinger, and he handled all Alaska legislative matters. But there was a gentleman named Bill Hoffman, who I guess they shared the legislative directorship. And Bill Hoffman did more of the national work. The Law of the Sea stuff and United Nations and other things that Gravel was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Stephen's side, I believe it was Steve Silver, who was the LA over there. He has a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. now, and I think Frank Ferguson must have been working for Don Young at the time.
I recognize that name.
He's a D.C. lobbyist now also.
Okay.
And you know who else might be great to speak to is John Katz.
Yeah.
Have you spoken with him?
No, but I know who he is. Was he the state's D.C. guy
He was
at the time?
State's, either that or he was in Interior at the time and then became the state's D.C. guy. But John had been the legal counsel for the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission when Joe Josephson and Esther Wanicky and the heir of Joe Josephson mm-hmm. and Esther Wanicky. And so John was the legal mind through all of that. And then I'm not sure where he went. Maybe he went to DNR or something in the state, maybe. Was he commissioner of DNR at one point?
I
can't remember. But he is in D.C. now, and he lasted through many governors and right. ran the state office in D.C.
Yeah, that's how I know his name, is the yeah. state office in D.C.
Outstanding mind on these
okay.
things.
Okay. You've mentioned that you and Senator Gravel and other staff traveled to Nome at some point.
I was not with the senator
okay.
on that trip. Don Argetsinger was, and I I know there was a meeting in Nome with Senator Gravel and Joe Reddington and Leo Rasmussen. Don recalls that it was a very busy, completely packed restaurant. I suspect it was the Board of Trade.
Which is the bar.
Yes. That's where a lot of work was done in Nome.
And did Don describe what happened at that meeting? Or what?
No, he assumes that it must have been a discussion about the Iditarod, but he doesn't remember particulars of the discussion.
He just remembers they were there. That's where you had your meetings.
They were there, and that Senator met with both Joe Reddington and Leo Rasmussen.
And did you have any interactions with Leo Rasmussen on your end? Did he?
Not until we came to the council. Not that I remember, but then when we were appointed, the Secretary of Interior appointed members to the advisory council. And Leo was on that.
So how did you get appointed to the advisory council?
Well, I suppose names were, I don't know, Secretary of Interior appointed me to that. I had come back to, by the time it passed, I had come back here. I suppose one or the other of the senators put my name up to the secretary, and that's how it happened. I mean, I don't know. I was asked if I would be willing to serve, and I was eager to serve on that.
And what were you doing you were in Anchorage by that point?
I was in Anchorage at that point. They created, the legislature created a group called the D2 Council on Alaska Lands. So this Council on Alaska Lands was supposed to deal with all the issues surrounding land claims, state, federal, and native at the time. And
that was different than the Alaska Task Force.
Yeah, I didn't work with the Alaska Task Force. What were they tasked with doing?
I think that was a Park Service thing, the Alaska Task
yeah.
Force. D2, it was D2 lands stuff.
Yeah, that was the federal side. This was the state sort of answer to, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to get our story out?
Yeah.
The sentiment from the governor's office, from the leadership in the legislature at the time, was that they were sort of being steamrolled by this D2 move because, mm-hmm. you know, the native land claims and the state land claims were just rolling along. That I think ANCSCA was passed in 72, I believe, and we became a state in 59. And, you know, we didn't have patent to hardly any of our lands.
Right.
In fact, we hadn't even finished all the selections. And So this was the state's official group to try and put forth the state's voice in that.
Okay. So you said you were eager to serve on the Iditarod Trail Advisory Council. Mm-hmm. Why were you eager?
Well, because I had worked on it, I had learned about all that history. The characters involved with it were delightful. They had all that ground truth. You know, Dan Seavey and Joe Reddington and, you know, Judy Bittner was on there, and she had all this history and knowledge about the state. It was, you know, it was an exciting thing to work on. I thought it was important. It's a part of the history that is makes us unique.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember some of what you did on the council or the meetings you guys had?
We had meetings. They were hosted by BLM. We met over at there's a facility over by Campbell Lake. Campbell Airstrip.
It's the Campbell Science Center.
The Science Center. Yeah, we met there. I'd have to pull up notes or find old files to remember all that we did. I know there was a discussion about becoming a 501c3. Mm-hmm. So that must have been under the knowledge that the council was going to sunset. So there was talk about that. And I believe John Buchholz actually drafted language for us, which came before the council. You know, the minutes of those must be over at BLM somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure. But it's more, you remember and experienced and the people and who did what.
Yeah. Well, we dealt with things like complying with the act, signage. How is it going to work? You know, and Joe Reddington said, well, traditionally we've used tripods. And how are we going to get those constructed? How are we going to make it uniform for the length of the trail? And, of course, we talked about education and having a logo. There was a logo that was developed for the trail. Uniformity of signage was big, and education to try and get materials into the schools to educate children about the history. We were focused on history and spreading the knowledge of the trails and what it meant and how significant it was to Alaska.
Do you remember any discussion about the land issues and the ownership and easements and all that?
Oh yes, big discussion about easements and the fact that we understood that the Iditarod Trail had not been put on the maps that were being used for the state land claims. And you know, Joe Redding's very familiar with the way it is, the way the trail went in the valley. And right now I think it goes, you know, through a subdivision and up somebody's driveway, and you know, you can't put signage there. But I don't think there was any consideration of the Iditarod when the original statehood claims were made, or the selections. Easements and the fact that, you know, condemnation, you can't acquire, I don't think you can acquire lands according to the act. At least there was no money appropriated for it. It was mostly about identification. So, and the act, I believe, accommodates the fact that it doesn't have to be continuous and it can be interrupted, but nevertheless you identify where the trail is, was, and its history is still relevant. Well, even though it's paved and it's somebody's driveway or basketball court now.
Yeah, or do they create alternate routes around it that make a continuous trail? It may not always follow the exact historic route, But you still have the trail.
Right, when you still have the trail, because people want to recreate on it.
Right.
I mean, the history and the usability sort of part company in a couple of places.
And that was okay?
That was okay. We weren't going to give up the trail because it wasn't continuous or because it was being contested because of someone's land selections.
Yeah. Well, and it's also...
The history still stood on its own.
Well, I'd say it's sort of a... Now people know the trail and where it goes, but at the time... It wasn't all brushed out. It hadn't been used in 100 years, I don't know. And so how you knew where to put it. And, you know, a trail got designated in an act, but there's no physical manifestation of it on the ground.
Ground. And that's why you go out and talk to people who had used it, whose ancestors had used it, who had used it for fishing, hunting, serum. You had to go out and do those interviews and do that research. And, you know, the legislature didn't have anything to do with that. But the studies that you're talking about that Pat worked on certainly were doing that.
Okay. So, yeah, you didn't go out and do any of that.
I was not brushing out any trail. I was brushing out political brush.
And then on the advisory council, did you guys go out into the communities?
We did. We held hearings. We were in Nome, I believe. We were in, it was 40 below. And Judy and I were bunking together. It was 40 below. Boy, if I had a map, I'd tell you. Yes, we did. We went out and held hearings or sort of community sessions. Where was that?
McGrath.
I think it was McGrath.
I'm thinking where would it have been 40 below McGrath?
Yes. I bought a new coat to go out there.
So what happened at those community meetings?
Well, people came and talked about the use of the trail. You know, we were in places that the race came through, and there was always some education to be done about we weren't race people. We were historic people. And what did people know about how the trail had been used and marked and that sort of thing.
And did communities come to your meetings? Did people come?
People came. I wonder if we've got pictures from any of those. Yeah, I know we were out on the trail in places meeting with communities to get feedback about historic uses.
And were you trying to drum up local groups to form for like students?
You know, I don't know if we were advocating for that. I think did Dan Seavey talk about that they wanted to get communities involved in working the trail?
Yeah, I mean, it was also in the comprehensive plan to have these advisory trailblazer groups
throughout the trail. That's ringing a bell. I'd forgotten about that. So I guess we were drumming up support for those. So we were following the stipulations in the act.
Well, that was in the comprehensive plan. So so what year did you get on the council? Do you remember?
The initial council, whenever it was formed, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I was on through several administrations. I think I was appointed by three or four different secretaries of interior.
And so you were on it until it sunsetted?
Or do you No, I don't think I was on until it sunsetted. I think I got busy doing other things and got off the council before it sunsetted.
Okay. Do you remember how the council worked with BLM?
BLM was the administrator. We had BLM staff helping us coordinating. There was a recreation specialist. I know somebody.
Terry O'Sullivan, Terry O'Sullivan and Dean Littlepage were the administrators.
Yes, and they were the bureaucrats. But there was a guy that was out on snow machines for the BLM. I will get you that name if I can't come up with it right now. There was a guy, and Pat Porcheau will probably remember this guy's name.
He may have done some of that with him.
Yes, it was a recreation guy with BLM, and they were actually building shelter cabins, and I can come up with
Lou
that
Waller?
For you. No.
Okay.
No.
One guy he
where's
mentioned.
Where's my contacts? Let's see if I can. What other names have
those
you got there?
That's the only ones I have that relate to that. Well, there was another one, but I think that was a Park Service.
No, there's a...
Larry Wild, that was Park
no,
Service.
This is... oh, man. I'll come up with it and get it back to you, and he would be excellent to talk to because he was sort of the guy that had to go out on the ground and actually do stuff. And
okay.
Pat Porcheau will probably remember who it was. I'm going to have to go through my contacts because his wife just contacted me recently. And I'll try and find it for you.
And that was on the ground, based here?
He was a BLM recreation specialist
out of Anchorage
okay. at the time. And they sent him all over the trail.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because I know that Dan and Lee and Seward talked about, you know, getting that southern part of the trail
marked
and
yes.
protected and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And working with Forest Service people.
Down there
down
would
there.
Be Forest Service. So you work with whatever agency the trail's going through.
Right. And so as an advisory council member, what was that like working with, you know, the federal land manager?
They were very accommodating. I mean, we had our marching orders. We had the statute, and they were doing the job. And, you know, I don't think we had any funding that came with it, and so they were the people that carried that. We used their facilities, and they were the implementers of the act.
And with no money, BLM had
yeah.
money to
BLM.
Throw in?
Well, the state. I don't think the state. Yeah, we had some travel money. It must have been BLM money that paid for, you know, the copying, the papers, the use of the facility when we traveled to McGrath or Nome or Seward. Can't remember who I turned my vouchers into, but we were reimbursed for those things, not for our time in any way. It was volunteer, of course.
Do you remember how often you guys met?
In the beginning, it was more often. It must have been quarterly. I don't know. Did Judy remember?
I didn't ask that.
Yeah. No, I don't remember how often we met. But, you know, we had subcommittees. I was working on coming up with articles of incorporation for us to consider being a nonprofit. And, you know, being able to do things under that umbrella. I suppose Joe and Dan were working on signage and marking the trail, having uniform markings on the trail. Probably BLM graphic artists were coming up with ideas for the logo. The logo was different than the historic trail logo was different than anything affiliated with the race. It's a pretty little triangle.
I've been asking about where that logo came from and the idea for it.
It was developed through the advisory council.
And do you know who worked on it or how it happened?
No, we realized we had to have a logo. I had been a graphic artist at one point with Department of Natural Resources, and so I suppose I was in on that discussion. But I think it would have been developed through the BLM.
Well, you mentioned subcommittees, so was there an education subcommittee?
I don't remember the subcommittees.
Other than...
Yeah, I know I was, there was a lot of talk. There must have been a keen awareness about this sunset and if we were going to be re-enabled. So I was working on the 501c3. I had done that for a couple other organizations.
While you were there, it didn't convert into a 501c3.
It wasn't officially converted while I was there, but we started the work on that.
Okay. When you got on the advisory council, were there specific goals you had in mind you wanted to see accomplished?
Well, just what was called out in the statute. I mean, we needed to establish the historical significance, get uniform markings, do the education component. That was it.
Do you feel like serving on that council, do you feel like it succeeded? Well,
I've lost track of it since I got off of it, but I know the Iditarod is still, you know, you mention the Iditarod when you're outside the state and people know it, probably because of the race. But it's known. And so we probably sort of piggybacked on the notoriety of the race, and were able to flesh out the history and keep the history because of it. What's the motivation of the university to follow this, to do this project?
Well, it comes from it's a project sponsored by the Iditarod Trail Alliance.
Oh, the Alliance, which is what has come out of...
Yeah, what it is now. And so it's just a reflection on the organization and the process and the trail itself and, yeah.
Its historic uses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's one of my questions, just is for anybody who serves on a council or mm-hmm. committee, how it worked, what did you do, who did you do things with, and did things work or not work? You know,
well, it sounds like they did work. If there's now an alliance that's established without a sunset, and I assume it's a 501c3, so they can do things to perpetuate the knowledge and of the. So yes, I guess I feel it's successful because the alliance emerged from it.
Right. Well, but also the question is, you know, serving on the council at that time, do you have memories of? There were issues or projects you wanted to see done that you couldn't do, and there were obstacles or frustrations, whether...
Money was always a question, and one of the things that we thought could be accomplished by creating a 501c3 is then you could get donations to do some of the things that needed to be done. The education component... interpretive signage, interpretive projects to, you know, get it out to the communities, certainly along the trail, but, you know, maybe work to get an Iditarod component in curriculum of Alaska education, things like that. We weren't going to get that money from the BLM. And so the thought of the 501c3 was that we would have that ability to do educational fundraising for education and purposes.
One thing I have heard, and also, I mean, I'm guilty of it as well, is many people in the state think the Iditarod Trail is there because of the dog race, not because it was used before that historically by the miners. Did you have to deal with that?
Well, yeah, we knew that the race was the high profile. Its profile was the race, and so of course our mission was to broaden it and to make it more than that. So we got to keep trying to do that.
Do you feel like you accomplished that?
Well, I think we made inroads. Yes, I mean the serum run is now taught to children. They follow the race because that's an exciting focal point. What I know from classrooms that my children's friends were in and now grandchildren are in is they follow the race, but they study the historic significance of it, that it was the serum. And I don't know to what extent the gold rush history is taught during that time, but so yes, I do feel there's been progress made on that. And who knows how long the race will run. It seems to be continuing, staggering along, despite some big challenges. But the history of that trail will prevail irrespective of a race, I think.
I had two questions and now one of them went out of my head, but the one was back to working for Gravel.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, you know, you kind of groom the senators, so to speak.
Well, we finessed the sponsorship.
Well, yes. Did you have to convince Gravel in any way about supporting the trail designation? Or
not in any way. I mean, I think it was obvious to both senators. You have to speak to the legislative guys on Stephen's side, but it's obvious that it's a good thing for Alaska. It's something that should be done. But we were always mindful of the vitriol between the two senators.
Right.
And so we sort of kept away from any discussion about, well, is the other guy in on this? It's just the right thing to do.
Right. Because I would think, it sounds like the Iditarod Trail was an easy one to get the senator to agree to. That would certainly not be the case for all issues.
Oh.
I mean, the staff sometimes has to convince a senator to support something or not.
Well, it's the staff's job to present all sides of an issue, where the threats are, where the advantages are, and let them decide if they want to blunt their sword on it.
Okay.
That's not a question with the Iditarod Historic Trail. So, yeah, I don't think it's the job of the staff to promote their own agenda. You know and understand where your senator comes from. If there's an issue that's going to come before them, you bring as much information to it as you can, and you let them decide if they're going to go out on point on it or not.
Okay. And so the Iditarod Trail, there were no negatives?
I don't think there was any negative. The only thing that, as a staff person, I might have perceived is, geez, if he thinks Stevens is going to be the prime sponsor on it, is he going to drag his feet sponsoring it? We didn't want that in any way to come into play. And you know what? I don't know if it was even ever stated overtly. It was just worked that way.
Right.
That it was obvious that it was the right thing to do, and we wanted to avoid any edginess about it.
Right. And yeah, the land ownership, conveyance, selection stuff wasn't seen as a hindrance?
As a threat to creating the trail?
Yeah, or an obstacle that was going to be there, so the trail designation would be harder to
I don't think accomplish. So. I think the history stands for its stands on its own.
Okay.
And at, you know, the office, well, Ted Stevens' office might have had land selection maps. Ted Stevens was a very, you know, he'd had experience at Interior. He was a very detail-oriented guy. He knew chapter and verse about the legislation he was dealing with. Mike Gravel was a big picture conceptual guy. Go deal with the details. He was dyslexic and had trouble tracking and dealing with minutia. And so I wasn't aware that anyone was thinking about conflicts at the time relative to the historical trail, that the history stood for itself and we needed to acknowledge it.
Yeah. Oh, I know what my question was on the advisory council, partnering with other groups. We mentioned a little bit the idea of trailblazers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the council building those relationships, either with trailblazers or other groups or agencies?
You know, I didn't have the contacts, the on-ground contacts that a CV or a Reddington had. So I wasn't active in that. I mean, that was part of our charge and part of what we did. So it was, you know, it was an administrative advocacy. And you go out into the communities and create interest, and you know, you're asking for volunteers to do things. And so your question, though, wasn't about that. It was about partnering with, like, the Park Strip, the BLM, or the Park Service, the BLM. Are you asking about that?
Yeah, or yeah, any partnering, whether it was with agencies or local organizations or educators or, you know.
I remember a willingness on the part of almost everywhere we approached. Money was always a question, and that's why we started thinking about this 501c3 thing. But yeah, people were enthusiastic about it.
Good.
We didn't have anybody say, "Oh no, get out of my face. We don't want to deal with you."
Right.
That I remember.
Right. And that's sort of the idea, too. Partnering brings money in,
mm-hmm.
if there was any of that happening that you remember, like joint projects you guys worked on.
Joint projects.
Well, and also, there was this comprehensive plan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that document and if that was guiding...
I'm sure it was guiding the agendas, the discussions, the action items, but I'm not recalling any of the details
of that. Joe was president while you were...
I don't know. Did we have a chair or a president? We might
have.
Did.
I know at the beginning they did.
Probably Joe then.
Joe was the chair at the beginning.
Okay. And then Dan, maybe?
I just have this... because it's from the comprehensive plan. It mentions Joe as the chair, and then just mm-hmm. has all these names, and there was, you know, the Department of Interior rep, State of Alaska rep, you know.
And so Judy was the State of Alaska rep, right?
Yeah, it started with Chip Dennerlein, and then she took over for him. And you're not listed on this initial 1981 list.
Yeah, I was in the initial one.
So you must have come after that. Edgar Callan passed away. Maybe you got appointed to replace him.
Maybe. Was he a public member?
He was from Caltag. You were a public member. He was an elder, Athabascan elder, and he died in April of 81. So it could be...
So I must have come on then.
Because you don't remember him.
Mm-mm.
So maybe you came on to replace him. This has Joe Reddington, Clay Beale,
mm-hmm.
William Coghill, Floyd Sherrock.
Sherrock?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chip Dennerlein, mm-hmm. Ken Chase from ANVIC, Ray Collins McGrath, Leroy Davey, Matsuburo, Wilda Hudson, Municipality of Anchorage, Andy Edge, Nome, Jack Garrison, Big Lake, Shirley Heatwool, Anchorage, Edgar Callan, Fritz Livesay, Anchorage, Michael Meehan, Seward, Roderick Perry, Chugiak, Clyde Peters, Galena, Rosemary Phillips, Nome, Dan Seavey, and Mary Shields from Fairbanks.
Was this a pre-group?
It's.
I don't think these were the approved by the secretary. I don't know.
Those.
It's not a familiar group to me.
Okay. Well, it's what is listed in the 1981 comprehensive plan as who the council members were. So that's interesting.
The council members were.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if it was a group that preceded.
So who do you remember? Do you remember?
Well, Dan and Joe and Judy and myself. I'd have to go back and look at, because I usually drew a table and wrote names. Jake was that guy's name. I'm about to come up with.
Jake Moore?
No, I'm about to come up with the guy's name that did the recreational stuff. Jake. What's his last name? I don't know where that came from. No, I don't. You know what? The brain's going foggy on me on those initial
names.
People. I know the ones that I worked closely with.
And then Leo, you said.
Leo, yeah. And see, he's not listed on there either.
No, he wasn't on the initial one. He came a little bit later. I can't remember.
So I don't know what happened to that. Maybe that initial one was until the nominations were made and approved.
It says appointed for 2-year terms. So maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Hmm. Yeah, maybe it didn't.
How long ago are we talking about?
That was 1981. And Judy didn't come on until 82. Yeah.
So that must have been when I came on, because she and I were in the same thing.
I'm getting closer.
Sorry.
That's okay. Anything else that you remember from or want to talk about?
No, nothing that pops up. It makes me think I should go in the basement and dig out the boxes of papers and see.
You put them in the archive.
And see what. So I don't know if agendas would be interesting to the archives, or if BLM has those.
I don't know. This is a question for Judy. What all they?
What would be pertinent?
Right. I know. Do you remember any connection with the serving on the advisory council being connected to the National Trails movement?
Well, just that there was a that there's a National Historic Trails designation, and there were advisory boards for the various sections, and we were completely separate. We didn't interact at all with any of the other advisory boards. The only connection was through the BLM. That was the only national connection.
Because there were National Scenic Trail and National Historic Trail conferences. You don't.
And I didn't go to any. Okay. Judy may have gone to
Judy and
some
Leo
of those.
Did.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if you might have.
No,
had any
I didn't
connection.
Go to. I didn't go to. And I'm sure we chose who we wanted to go to those, and it was obvious that Judy would go.
Okay, and so during the time you were on the council, well, you started. You were on that D2 Lands Council, and then
By then I was not. I was just a private citizen, and I was running my husband's medical corporation in the private sector.
So I was wondering how you juggled jobs
council. Yeah, no, I had been on the D2 Council on Alaska Lands, and then I got married and started to raise a family and run my husband's medical corporation. So that was as an individual.
Yeah, I mean, how much time did being on the council take up anyway?
If you engaged in, you know, talking to lawyers about getting articles of incorporation drafted and going to the meetings and being prepared for it, I mean, it took time. It was a priority.
Okay. Yeah, and you didn't work on any of the land conveyance easements, like working with native corporations or private landowners.
No.
On the portion that crossed their lands.
No, I mean, I think that was done with maps and some office somewhere with the stakeholders there advocating for whatever they wanted. But I wasn't in on any of that.
Did the council have to vote and approve on any of those things?
No, that was not within their authority. I mean, that was a fight with all the land selection entities, with the state, the feds, and the Native groups that were making their claims. That was totally out of our purview. We just identified, obviously, where there was a conflict and someone else had to deal with it. We didn't advocate one way or the other. I mean, we advocated for the trail to be acknowledged, for it to be marked. If someone wanted to donate their land, we would have been happy to have, you know, worked on that, but it wasn't our authority.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you're doing this. And I'll go dig in the papers. I've been trying to downsize recently, so they may have been tossed out, but I might find some gems in there.
Great, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.